Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 4, delivered on January 22, 2015. The title of this lecture is Financial Institutions.
Today, financial institutions. Financial institutions is a fancy way of saying banks and things like banks that go bump in the night. Financial institutions include banks, but they include, when I say banks, I mean I could be talking about a lot of different kinds of animals, and I will go through those, and you might find some facts in this lecture that are worth you knowing, just for your practical reasons, practical purposes, and at the lecture will close with an interesting little graphic that might change your thinking about some things. I don't know, maybe it will. But this chapter in the book is sort of, in some ways, it is painfully detailed in a way that I'm not going to test you on. But in other ways, it just sort of quickly glosses over a huge thing known as the Federal Reserve. Get off me. Let me kill this mic. There. Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. The Federal Reserve, and I put up an article for you to read, and I want you to read that, and I'll give you a little more background on that in a minute. But I'm also going to put up a video that is produced by the Federal Reserve of St. Louis, Bank of St. Louis. It's a cartoon video. I think it lasts about 10, 15 minutes. It's cheesy, sort of dorky looking, but it actually is a pretty decent introduction to the Federal Reserve System. And I'll be going through that with you in this lecture. But first, let me talk about financial institutions more broadly. First of all, you got your basic bank, Chase Bank, or something like that. It's a place where you can create an account. And if it's a checking account, the technical name for that is a demand deposit account. A demand deposit account. Because if you write me a check, I can go to your bank and demand immediate satisfaction of that draft instrument you have issued to me. They can't say no to that, because it is a demand deposit. Immediately upon representation with credentials and all that kind of stuff, they have to give me the money. Some years back, when I was a consultant, a company sent me a corporate check for $2,000, and it was written on a very reputable bank, and I went to a branch in Columbus, Ohio, to cash it. I wanted the money. I needed to pay rent. I needed to feed my cats. And they said, well, no, we're not going to do that right away. Well, you can give it to us, and we'll hold it for a couple of weeks, and then you can come back, and we'll give you the money if everything's okay. And so I, at that point in the game, I said, I'm going to leave here. I'm going to call the Federal Reserve, and I'm going to have them call you and explain to you what a demand deposit is. And somehow they managed to find $2,000 in the vault for me. You see, because they have to give me the money. It's a demand deposit. In other words, demand deposits are among the most liquid of instruments there are. Checking accounts at banks. Now, other things that are liquid. Other things that are liquid. Hold out your hand for me. if you close your hand, I will eat your butt. Okay, and I don't like butt. No, I got some. That is as liquid as you can get. Now give it back to me. Did you wash your hands before class?
No.
Oh, man. See, that's like... Anyway, cash and currency. The most liquid. As a matter of fact, cash and currency have their own monetary aggregate. No one ever talks about it much. It's called M0. Cash and currency is the most liquid of all. You can go to Wendy's and get a burger there. You can go and get potato chips at Snarf and Barf. Most liquid, M0. Now, so we've got this M0. And then a little bit less liquid, that check. I mean, some places might not take a check. So we would say, all right, the next most liquid monetary aggregate would be M0. What's an M0? Plus demand deposits. And traveler's checks would be in there. Now, have any of you ever used traveler's checks? They used to be really popular. You could don't leave home without them. They were just like cash anywhere in the world. And they were very nice to use. But they're in this, they are highly liquid, but they're very rarely used, certainly not as popular as they once were, but they are highly liquid. So this monetary aggregate M1 would have cash and currency, which is M0, plus demand deposits, plus traveler's checks. That would be M1. That's the one that usually we start talking about when we talk about monetary aggregates. The most liquid money in the world. And then, okay, let's go on and talk about something higher that wouldn't have as, that would include some things that didn't have quite as much liquidity in them. Okay, M2. M2 would include M1, which includes M0. So we start M2 with cash and currency, demand deposits, and traveler's checks. And then we throw in something else, less liquid. Certificates of deposit, CDs. Small-time deposits. Interest penalty for early withdrawal. In other words, they are not quite as liquid because you're going to suffer a little bit of a hit for turning it into cash. So M2... includes cash and currency, M0. Demand deposits and traveler's checks, M1, plus small certificates of deposit, small CDs. You can get your money out of a CD. You're just going to take a little hit if you get it out too early. So that's M2. And then there is this animal above that one. It's M3. Now, the Federal Reserve stopped publishing M3, the growth rate of M3, back in 2006, I think it was. They said, no one ever looks at it. Who cares about it? Well, there was another reason they did it. That was a lie. And I'll show you all that in a little while. But M3 has M2 in it. Cash and currency, demand deposits, traveler's checks, and it also has, and then it has M2 in it, which is the small-time deposits, and then it has this highly illiquid stuff in it. China's going to dump the dollar. China's going to dump the dollar. Why are they not going to do that? Well, there's another reason. It's much, much, much more clear. Yeah? You got it. Yeah, because if they dump the dollar, the supply of dollars, they start dumping dollars. What happens to the value of the dollar? If the supply of dollars on the open currency, global currency markets goes up, what happens to the value of dollars on the global currency markets? Supply goes up, price goes down. And what does that mean for that? The value of the assets in the Central Bank of China, which is mostly dollars, goes down into hell. And so they essentially, it would be one of those things where we're going to kill you by shooting a bullet through our head to get to your head. They're not going to do it. They're not stupid. So that's not much of a worry. But they are going to have the power over us. They lend us money so that we can run massive federal deficits, have big wars, have lots of spending, have low taxes, and all those tax cuts as far as the eye can see, because we can borrow our own money back from those who first got it in the capital markets. They can also lend money to you for that Ferrari that you're going to buy, for you for that PhD at Harvard, for you for that double-wide trailer on the outskirts of Decatur. They're going to lend us all money. They're going to, when our corporations need money for debt, they want to issue bonds. The capital markets have places, and they are over there. When they want to sell stock, ownership in corporations, that money is always available. It's American dollars, so they've got, the Chinese have to spend them here. The Arabs have to spend their American dollars here. The Japanese do. The Europeans do. They spend them here. They have to because they're American dollars. And so we've got all kinds of things. We just can't stop spending. You'll borrow money. You'll be up to your ass in debt. And it will come from somewhere. For your student loans, for these obscene tuitions you pay. I didn't mean that. This is a very affordable education, in fact. For those homes that are the McMansions down in Sarasota, for all of those pretty things in our lives that we can't afford, but we're going to buy them anyway, for those pretty wars that we have of choice that we have, and we can have low taxes, we can have promises, we're going to keep them tax cuts for you, we're going to give more tax cuts, oh, we'll tax the rich. Sure, they're going to tax the rich will essentially sell them out of office if they do that. This is the way we have been living our lives for a very long time, and we just keep rolling on. Eventually it'll come to an end, but that's your problem, not mine. The Federal Reserve, anyway. By the way, I forgot. Go back to M2. M2, there was one other thing I forgot to put in there. It's really important, actually. It's called Negotiable Order of Withdrawal Accounts. Now accounts. That's an M2. Almost forgot about it. It's actually kind of a little thing that you might want to know about. Yeah. Negotiable order of withdrawal accounts. Now accounts. Do any of you have a checking account at a credit union? A lot of you do. Those are not bank checking accounts. They are not demand deposit accounts. They are now accounts. Now accounts, legally, theoretically, if you write me a check from a credit union account, your credit union account, you write me a check, I go to your credit union, they don't have to honor it immediately. They will probably, but they don't have to. Because negotiable order of withdrawal accounts are not as liquid as demand deposit accounts. Almost always they will honor it right away. If I go in there and I've got your check, they'll give me the money. But they don't have to. At a bank, if that were a bank check and I went to your bank, they would have to. But a now account doesn't have to. So credit unions do have a lot of wonderful things about them, and I'll mention a few of those here in a little bit. But one of the problems they have is that, I'll be darned, they are not quite as liquid. That's why the now accounts are in M2, not in M1. M1 has the bank checking account money. M2 has the credit union checking account money. As a matter of fact, I don't know if this rule still applies, but back in the day, If it was not a bank checking account, they couldn't use the word check, C-H-E-C-K. They had to spell it C-H-E-Q-U-E as a sort of a visual distinction. If it were a NOW account, checking account, the check had to be spelled C-H-E-Q-U-E. I don't know if that rule is still in effect or not anymore, but for all intents and purposes, it's a very liquid instrument, a bare draft from a credit union, but it doesn't have to be that way. I'm going to show you something here. Okay, now the bank, the book goes through all these different financial institutions. You've got banks, the traditional bank, the kind of bank you think about. And then, of course, you've got these credit unions. But in terms of banks, just plain old banks, there are a lot of different kinds of those. One of the ways that we can distinguish is based upon how the bank was chartered. Some banks are chartered federally, federal banks. And then there are banks that are chartered by states. There's state banks. And those are overseen by the state regulators. Then you have other kinds of animals, different kinds of banks. There used to be a kind of bank that's almost like a credit union. They were very popular back a long, long time ago. They were called mutual banks. Mutual banks, in a way, they're sort of like a cross between modern community banks and credit unions. A mutual bank worked this way. You wanted a checking account at that bank, you actually had to apply to have a checking account. Because if they gave you a checking account, you became one of the owners of the bank. You voted on the executive officers. You voted on policy. You were an owner of the bank in these old mutual banks. And they didn't expand very far. They were more community-based. And let me tell you, the officers and directors of those banks, they'd walk down the street, they'd see the owners of the bank. So they were not likely to be con men or screw-ups or anything like that because they lived in the community where the owners were. Mutual banks were quite successful and survived very well in recessionary environments, unlike many major banks did. Okay, they've kind of gone away now. But there are other kinds of financial institutions, too. There are things called savings and loans, and then a variation on that called the building and loan. There was an insanely large scandal involving savings and loans in the 1980s, and they lost a lot of their luster, and you don't see them much anymore. But back in the old days, I mean, you'd see a savings and loan or a building and loan in most small towns in America, but they're not very common now. And then there are all kinds of other banks. But here's the upshot of it. Regulation. Who regulates the banks? Well, you've got some banks are overseen by the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States. But there are some other federal banks that are overseen by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And then there are other banks that are overseen by other federal agencies. And then the state banks are overseen by state regulators. And the credit unions are overseen by credit union regulators. In other words, there is no central regulator of all banks in the United States. There is no central regulator. Well, that can cause you to get all kinds of excited when you've got a financial crisis. Well, who was in charge? Well, we're not sure about that. What does that mean? Okay, financial crisis of 2008, pointing fingers, you weren't regulating these banks very well. Well, you weren't. Okay, let us get a final central regulator that oversees all of the financial institutions of the United States. Sounds like finally a great idea. Didn't happen. Turf war. There's no way these regulators of all these different entities were going to give up their turf to the Federal Reserve. No, we're not going to let the Federal Reserve regulate our banks. Our banks weren't the ones that went tap city, belly up, and all of that during the crisis. And so this idea of getting finally a central one regulator of all the financial institutions in the United States didn't happen. So there you are. Now, the book goes through this maze of who regulates what in the United States. I'm not going to hold you accountable for that. Just know that it is a mess right now. You take a course in money and banking from me or from one of our other great finance professors, you'll hear all about it. It's dizzying, how insane it is. It's also fraught with a couple of major perils. Now we get to the Federal Reserve. In the 1800s, our financial system, our financial institution framework was a free market, Wild West mess. Banks were just offering the moon, promising everything, lying to investors, doing pyramid schemes, and then there would be runs on banks. Banks don't keep all of your deposits. They lend most of it back out and keep only a fraction. So if too many people come in and want their money back too fast, the bank just folds. Those runs on banks happened over and over again in the late 1800s. Just a fiasco. And it was so bad that it was beginning to have macroeconomic consequences. It was also being gamed by some very, very rich, powerful people and families. They would start rumors that a bank was on the brink of insolvency. The bank was perfectly fine, but when people heard that there was a problem, they all ran the bank, and of course the bank folded up. It just boom, right there. And so then these rich people, these powerful shadowy interests, would just step in and take that bank for pennies on the dollar. It was a brilliant scam over and over again. Well, like I said, it finally got so serious. So many people were being screwed over, losing their money. Their bank accounts were gone. Just over and over again was happening. That Congress finally said, all right, this is just insane. We need a central bank that's going to oversee all banks, going to get this mess under control. Finally, in the 1917, the Federal Reserve Act was passed. It established the Federal Reserve System in the United States. It divided the country into 12 districts, each of which would have a district bank of the Federal Reserve. Unfortunately, that the way the population was distributed back then, the districts on the East Coast were very small because of the density of population. The districts on the West Coast were huge because it was not that many people, not that many banks. And that means that now that system is kind of antiquated because you've got the District Bank of San Francisco overseeing insane amounts of territory, banks, and all that. That's the way it is, you know. 12 district banks. Now, the Federal Reserve has a board of governors, 7 of them. They are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. One of those 7 serves as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. One of those 7 serves as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Yeah. The Senate. Yeah, so in other words, recently we had a board of governors position open up, and President Obama appointed someone, and then that person was confirmed by the Senate. As a matter of fact, the chairman, Ben Bernanke, the former chairman, retired last year, was it? It was last year. And so there was a board position open, and it was the chairman position on the board that opened. And so what President Obama did was to appoint Janet Yellen. And then she went through the confirmation process in the Senate. Now, And then she was already a governor, I believe. And so her position opened up, her former board position opened up. And so President Obama appointed someone to that position, and that person was approved. Now, the Board of Governors, again, there are seven. One of them is the chairman. Don't let me bluff you on an exam. The Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve has seven governors plus one chairman. No, it has seven governors, including the chairman. Don't let me bluff you with that. Okay, trust me, this goes somewhere. I got to get through the grueling part, and then there's something really interesting I want to show you at the end of this whole story. What was I thinking? Okay, now, the district banks, each district bank oversees all the banks in its territory. The Board of Governors regulates the banking system. And then those regulations are used by the district banks to supervise their banks in their area. So the Board of Governors regulates, the district banks supervise. Again, the board regulates, the district banks supervise. Show you something here. This is a dollar bill. You see that big letter right there on the side?
One.
No, not the one. What is that thing right there?
It's an I.
That's an I. Okay? Actually, on the back, there's a seeing I, but that's all conspiracy theory. There's nothing there. Just look on the front. What does that I say around it?
It's actually kind of hard to read.
Dude.
Indianapolis.
So in other words, this one came out of the Bank of Indianapolis, one of the district banks. There are banks. We are actually on a boundary almost between two of the big central district banks, the one in Chicago and the one in St. Louis. Now, right here, we are under the banks right around here, the federal banks under the Federal Reserve's control are under Chicago. Just a little south of here, you're in the St. Louis Bank. Each of these different district banks, they supervise the banks in their area, but they also participate in other things too. Each bank is kind of known for something that it does. Like, for example, one will be the data center of all the banks. And then there will be other, like, for example, St. Louis. They are well known for providing all kinds of resources for economists, for students, for the public. And they've got, if you go to the central bank, on my website, isu-prof.com, there's a link to the St. Louis Bank's website. They've got all kinds of stuff. They were the ones that made that video that I'm going to post for you guys to watch. They have resources for college, for high schools, for elementary schools. They even have games on that site. I've never played them. I don't even want to think about what kind of a game, like video games or something like that. I don't know. But St. Louis Bank is a great bank. I took my students down there last year? Yeah, down in St. Louis Central Bank. They were very helpful, really nice, great people. Great place to look for an internship or a job. Go to the Chicago Bank, completely different world up there. I mean, they are real strict, real secretive. I took my students and I wanted them to go into this room where they have things like a pile of money and stuff like that. And it was like, they were treating us like we were criminals or something in there. The line of students, there was this huge guard at the door. And she was watching us like a hawk. And she herded us all. You know, she had her baton like this. She herded us all into this line to go into this narrow passage to go into the museum room. And I'm at the back of the line. And just as I get to the place where I could go through, she hits me with her baton. You know, oh, God, you cow. You know, go eat a pizzeria or something. What are you doing? Turned out she was really great. I got her number. And, you know, anyway. but Anyway, some very different characteristics of the different banks. Okay, now, the 12 district banks. The bank presidents, they are the cream of the crop of the banking industry. In some ways, that's not the best thing. We are always bringing the insiders inside. But these men and women who are the district bank presidents are just consummate professionals. They are dressed to the nines all the time, very diplomatic in everything they do. I mean, they've never had a speeding ticket. I don't think any of them have ever had sex. But at the same time, they are very stable people, cream of the crop. Interestingly, I used to say that about the Board of Governors, too, in Washington, D.C. I can't say that anymore. I mean, you've got people on that board now who are, one of them is a former dinner theater actress. She ran a community bank until she drilled it into the ground. It was bought out by another bank that required that she leave the bank if they were going to buy it. And now she's a governor. So I can't really talk as highly about the governors as I can the district bank presidents. They're bright, bright, great, great stewards of their districts, for the most part. A few have screwed the pooch, but we'll get to that later. Now let me have one of those pieces of paper you were talking about. You can just tear it out. Stop being dainty, for heaven's sakes. But the deal is this. I'm going to write down a few things here in just a minute, but I want to go through some basics. The Federal Reserve has three separate duties. The Federal Reserve has three separate duties. Duty one is that it regulates and supervises the banking system, or at least it's part of the banking system. That's its duty. A second duty of the Federal Reserve is that it serves as a bank for banks. Madam, do you have a bank that you bank with? Well, if you do, a bank needs one too. It can't use itself. Well, we're going to deposit this money at our bank, which is us. No, they can't do that. So every bank has to have a bank. And there are banks that do this. They're called commercial banks. And interestingly enough, the Federal Reserve is one of them. But there are private ones, too, that the Federal Reserve directly competes against in an open market. The requirement is that the Federal Reserve, it does lots and lots of technological innovation, and it has to share everything that it develops with its private competitors. It has to turn over any money that it makes in profits to the U.S. Treasury. And the Federal Reserve turned over an enormous amount of money last year. It goes straight up, head-to-head, with private providers of commercial banking services. It's been probably about 5 years ago, it finally occurred to me, some student asked me, well, doesn't the Federal Reserve take it all? Don't they get every bank? Don't all banks go to them? And I thought, well, I know these commercial banks are out there, so they must be getting some business. So I called St. Louis, where I know some people, and I asked them at the Federal Reserve, and I said, okay, what's the balance between banks that use your banking services and banks that use private commercial banks for their banking services? And he gave me a number. He said it actually varies from district to district. He said in the St. Louis district, he gave me a number. He said it's around 60% of banks use the Federal Reserve, 40% use commercial banks. And so that might give you a rough estimate. Also, those private commercial banks, they are highly, highly profitable. They make money hand over fist. They are not hurt by this by the competition from the Fed. This gives you back when the whole healthcare debate was going on, back before Obamacare was passed, I wrote a letter to the senator here in Illinois, and I said, why are you doing this? Why don't we just create a healthcare system, health insurance system, like the Federal Reserve does with our banking? we create a public version, and it competes head-to-head with the private insurers and do the same rules. Whatever innovations are made by the public provider, they have to be shared with the private providers. We have clear evidence that this does not destroy private markets at all, but it does make them highly competitive. Well, no one even paid attention. I never even heard back on that. So, but know this, there is a model for a public competitor with private markets that doesn't hurt either one and makes for a lot of efficiency in the market. Just keep that in mind sometime if you're hearing a debate about healthcare, national healthcare. Again, okay, we've got regulation supervised banks, serves as a bank for banks, third duty, conducts monetary policy. Conducts monetary policy. Now, as far as conducting monetary policy goes, the Fed has three tools that it can use. And this, trust me, this gets a little grueling right here. And I'll go through with it a few times before I ever quiz you or test you on part of this. Part of it's kind of easy and simple, but some of it is a little bit of a, it takes a while to get it. And I know that not, despite the fact that almost all of you have already had your economics course, this the one of these three tools, open market operations, is just not something that you've heard or get yet. So I do appreciate that. We'll go through it several times. And I'll go through it once lightly, and then I'll go back, and we'll cover it again in the next lecture just to get you up to speed on it. By the way, there will be a quiz this weekend, but it won't have that on it, certainly. Okay. Really? Let's try using the overhead projector. No, excuse me. The heck was that? That hurt like hell. Need some more of Jack. Really? Okay. Now, okay. First thing, the three tools. One of them is extremely blunt. I mean, it's a tool that you probably, it wouldn't even be used to control the money supply. It would be used for other purposes, but it is a money supply controller. Okay. You, sir, had $1,000, $100 fall, you don't deserve $1,000, $100 just fall out of the sky into your hand. So you said, well, this is incredible. And being a responsible, upstanding young stud, you said, I'm going to put this in the bank. So in the bank, deposit, you put $100. We would call this the initial amount of money, M sub zero. Now, I am a responsible banker, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to put 10% of that in reserve. Required reserve, 10%. So that if you come back, I've got some of your money for you. And that leaves lendable, not loanable, lendable, $90. Well, you come to me with this idea. Yes, what is your idea? I need to borrow money. For what? I want to open my own massage parlor. I've changed my name to Rolf, and my partner here, Gunter, and we're going to run the Rolf and Gunter Day Parlor. Okay, how much do you need? $90. Well, that's great. So I lend you this $90, and you build their facility and their website, rolfandgunter.com. Swedish, not German, Swedish. And it's not Gunther. Say your name. What is it? It's not. No, no. What's
Gunther?
No, it's Gunther. Gunther. And yours is Rolf. And your muscles go ripple, ripple. $90 for you, and you bring it to my bank and deposit $90. The money supply has expanded. So I've got this $90. I've got to put $9 in reserve, and you show up. Oh, no, no, you show up. And you tell me I need to borrow money. For what? For a bakery. A bakery. What's your first name? No, 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 that's his. You're Sven. Sven's Bakery. Sven's Bakery. We specialize in Swedish pastry. Okay? Okay. How much do you need? Well, I need $81. Well, I'll be darned. I've got $81. And I'm going to lend it to you. So, you design the building, you build his pastry, he pays you the $81 to do it, so you come to my bank and you put $81 into my bank. $81. Well, I'm going to keep $8.10 of that on reserve, and the remainder I can lend out. Do you see what's happening in this process? The money supply is expanding on the balance sheet of that bank. This is how the money supply can expand just off $100. How much does it ultimately show up as money in our system from just your $100? If you were to add these all up down the line, you would actually, the way you do it is you the money multiplier will be, it's a simple one. There's a more complex one. I think they bring it up in the book. I won't hold you for the more complex one. It's just basically 1 over the required reserve ratio. So in this case, since the required reserve ratio is 10.1, the money multiplier is 10. So the change in the amount of money in the economy from a single deposit is the initial deposit times the money multiplier, which in this case would be $100 you kicked in times the money multiplier 10. So $1,000 was created off that one deposit. The Federal Reserve sets the required reserve ratio. The Federal Reserve sets it. So you notice that if the Federal Reserve increases the required reserve ratio, the money multiplier goes down. The money supply does not expand as fast. If the Federal Reserve lowers the money multiplier down to 5, let's say, that would make the money multiplier 20, and it would expand at this insanely larger rate. It's a blunt tool. Someone, again, this was a few years back, someone said, well, what actually is a required reserve ratio? And I didn't know what it was, quite honestly. I call myself a macroeconomist, and I didn't know what it was. But I do know that it goes up and down. Mostly, the Federal Reserve doesn't push it up and down to regulate the money supply. Usually what it does is if there is a sense that people are worried about banks, they will increase the money. They will increase the required reserve ratio to make sure the banks have plenty of money in the vault if everyone runs the banks. And if people are very confident about the economy, the Federal Reserve will ease back on this because they're pretty sure no one's going to run in and demand all their money right away. So that's more the driving factor in what the required reserve ratio is. But anyway, someone asked me, well, what is it right now? Didn't know. Called St. Louis. I said, all right, what's the required reserve ratio? And this guy, I know this guy, he almost treated me like I was asking a dumb question. You know, I said, I know, I should know it. He said, no, you're asking a question that actually doesn't make sense in a way. He said, there is not a required reserve ratio. He said, there are 3. Wait, what? He said, yeah. He said, based upon how much money the bank has, its tranches, T-R-A-N-C-H-E-S or something like that. Tranches. That's what drives the required reserve ratio. He said, so the tranche for the first 10 million is not the required reserve ratio is not the same as for 10 million to 100 million, and that required reserve ratio isn't the same as the one for 100 million and above. It was, the numbers were something like that, and it's still on the website. I found, he told me where to look to find what it was at any given time. The thing that shocked the hell out of me, the required reserve ratio for the first tranche, 0 to 10 million, is zero. There isn't. They can lend out every penny of the first $10 million, which kind of gives, first of all, what, you see that money multiplier there? See that? 1 over 0. What is 1 over 0? Yeah, infinity. Or so it's error on your calculator, or whatever. So basically, that first tranche grows, has the ability, it doesn't, but it has the ability to grow at a nearly infinite rate. And then it goes up from there. If I remember right, the second tranche, the required reserve ratio was a little above 6% of the deposits, and the third tranche was somewhere around 9%. I can't remember the numbers exactly, but they were not large numbers. All of them indicated a money multiplier that was very aggressive. In other words, expand the money supply quickly. Yeah.
Okay, so that money is what the bank has, right?
On its balance sheet.
So most banks would have more than like 100 million, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's your thing. Have you ever noticed in this town or in other towns how these banks just kind of pop up out of nowhere with new names and weird names? They just kind of show up out of nowhere. Well, it's almost like a Wild West. If you can get a bunch of people to deposit their money, you stay under that $10 million first tranche. You can lend out every penny of what people are putting in, depositing in their checking accounts, and you can multiply your balance sheet rapidly off that, like a lever. It's like a lever. Here's the second one. Remember the three tools. This is the bluntest tool. It's just a meat cleaver of a tool. And like I said, if the Federal Reserve wanted to change the money supply, this would not be the way they would do it, by changing that required reserve ratio. They try to leave that pretty stable. The second one is what is called the discount rate. One was the required reserve ratio. The second one is called the discount rate. The discount rate is the rate at which the Federal Reserve will lend money to banks. The Federal Reserve will set a rate that it will charge at the discount window to lend money to banks that need some money. That's a little window, and that's some dollar bills. Most banks that needed money were not going to go to the discount window. They have an alternative called the federal funds market. Banks all have their money in this giant theoretical pool floating like an ocean. All of the money of the banks is in there. And usually banks historically would go to that pool and borrow money. The thing though is that after the crisis of 2008, the Federal Reserve, low interest money, they're using the economy and they are using it for the purpose of lining their own pockets. Know this, the Federal Reserve cannot set the federal funds rate. It targets it. It says we want the federal funds rate to be here, but it cannot set the federal funds rate because that is a free market driven rate driven by the supply of and demand for lendable funds in the federal funds pool. You will see it's endless on these financial news programs. The Federal Reserve met the Federal Open Market Committee met today and they set the federal funds rate at. No, they didn't. They can't. It is a free market rate. They can manipulate it through open market operations, which I cover next, but they can't set the thing. They can set the discount rate, but not the federal funds rate. third one, and this is the open market operations. And this is the one I'll go through a couple of times, because sometimes I ask and people will say, yeah, we covered this in econ, or no, we didn't cover this in econ. I was stoned in econ. Wait, what was your question in econ? So I have to go through it a couple of times, because I honestly don't think you're really exposed to it very well. But it is so important that it's like you're starting to see a window of the world that the common person doesn't know about. The open market operations are conducted by the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. The FOMC has 12 voting members. The seven governors are permanent voters. But then there are five of the district bank presidents as voting members. Four of them serve two-year terms in rotating fashion. You know, you'll have the Bank of Atlanta, its president is on for 2 years, then his 2 years term is up, and then he might be replaced by the Bank of St. Louis bank president. One of them is permanent. That is the district bank president of the New York Fed. The New York Federal Reserve District Bank is called the Empire Bank. He is a permanent voting member. And there's a reason for that. Because at the New York Fed, there is a very special operation called the Domestic Trading Desk, the DTD, which is where the open market operations are executed. I'm going to do my first pass at this now, and it'll be a light pass on this. The FOMC, you and all of you were all on the voting on it. We voted to expand the money supply. Okay, you are the district bank president of New York. It's going to be your bank's job to actually execute this expansion. You carry the portfolio of instructions back from the FOMC committee. They've voted, let's make the money supply expand, boost the economy. So you go back to the New York Bank. You are the manager of the domestic trading desk. Now, when I say desk, I'm not talking about one of those IKEA stupid-ass things. I'm talking about floors of traders, Fed traders. You're the manager. You say, we want the money supply expanded. So you send out the word to the traders, the Fed desk traders. Now, in any given situation, you're going to have the two most liquid instruments on earth, dollar bills and treasury bills. I'm a bank here in Sad Place, USA. Now, in my highly liquid Tier 1 portfolio, in the vault, I have dollars. Actually, they're in the federal funds pool. And I also have T-bills, highly liquid instruments that make my bank safe. You call me. You want to expand the money supply, because what you have as a trader at the Fed, you have dollars and you have T-bills. If you want to expand the money supply, you're going to call me. Ring, ring. Hello. Hi, I'm a Fed trader. I would like to buy some of your T-bills. Why the hell you want to buy my T-bills? Because we want you to have more money. Well, what are you going to pay me for my T-bills? $950. Go to hell. Click. So you call me back. Ring, ring, what? What are you going to do? I didn't want to sell you my T-bills at $950. So what are you going to do?
Counteroffer?
Offer me something then. Tell me. No, God, oh my, 1,000 is all I'm going to get back for God's sake. Dude, no. No, 950. You want me to sell you my T-bills? Say 975 and I'll leave you alone, okay? 975. Go to hell. So you hand it off to you. You understand that I'm playing hard to get. No, I'm not that kind of a bank president. You are kind of cute, though. Muscular. Oh, anyway, okay, now offer me something else. Try to induce me.
$985.
Good. You see what he's doing? To get my T-bills, they are demanding the price of T-bills upward. When the price of T-bills goes upward, what happens to the yield on T-bills? You remember that first lecture? Price goes up, yield goes down. Spank me, Jesus. Because what's happening now is that not only are you, I'm going to give up one of my T-bills to you so it goes out of my portfolio and into yours. You send me more dollars. You're expanding the money supply in the federal funds pool. And at the same time, what you are doing is pushing the interest rates on treasury bills downward in the process. You're boosting the economy two ways. You're filling up the pool of federal funds with more money from banks, and you're also pushing down the rates on risk-free rate, which makes all rates begin to slide downward. But then, as the federal pool of funds fills up, the supply of lendable funds goes up. And if the supply of lendable funds goes up, what happens to the federal funds rate? Supply goes up, rate goes up. Say it out loud. Don't be afraid. Down. You should, you know, show us her. Down, man. You should know this. You're teaching us. Yeah, you know, say it to me like that. Yeah, it's going down. So you see what you're doing. They are actually pulling different levers. They can't set the federal funds rate, but through these open market operations, they can push it in different directions. So what does all this mean? The upshot of this whole lecture. Is this thing suck or what? Oh, yes, it does. Okay. What's the history of the Federal Reserve? Now, I told you I have written about economics and finance for years. My websites were finally attacked and destroyed last year, and I'm still in the process of rebuilding the disaster of losing 400 articles. I still have all my graphics that I was publishing. I was calling that there was going to be a disaster coming, a financial apocalypse, I called it, in the months leading up to 2008. I wrote two different series. One was a four-part series called The Economics of Wreckage, explaining why what was going to happen was going to happen. I then also wrote a two-part series attacking the Federal Reserve because it was part of the disaster. The only thing that I didn't do in that series that I regret now is that I didn't source it clear back to the root causes of the Wild West that was happening in the financial services industry, which is going on even worse now than it was then. The roots of this were in the repeal of a regulatory act called Glass-Steagall. That was done in the last years of the Clinton administration. It essentially just took all the reins off banks, and they've just gone crazy ever since. And I didn't assign enough blame. I give Clinton credit for having an incredibly successful economy. And I give a lot of criticism to the Fed for some of the things that it did early on that were trying to cripple that successful economy. But let me show you a graph here. This was part of the series, The Economics of Wreckage, and then it was also in the Federal Reserve Under Fire, as I was trying to warn that something really bad was going to happen. I want you to notice here, this was where, by the way, the Fed stopped publishing M3, claiming that no one used it, who cares about it. Look what was happening to M1 this is growth rate. This is growth rate. This isn't level. This is the growth rate. Notice that by about 2006, the growth rate of M1, the money that people use, that small businesses use, had gone to average zero. In other words, the economy was expanding, but the liquidity to keep it expanding had been taken out. It wasn't expanding. The best reason we can estimate that the Fed was doing something that insane was that M2 was expanding too fast, and this one had just gone completely wild. This is a growth rate of M3 caused by the insane amount of money that was flowing into euro dollars. As we bought all these things from overseas, the Chinese, the Canadians, the Arabs, the Japanese, the Europeans were getting all of these American dollars, which were accumulating as this massive overhang of highly illiquid money. That's why the Federal Reserve stopped publishing M3. It wasn't because no one uses it. It was because it was going at this ghastly rate of growth that was going heading towards 20%. So that was essentially almost a no-brainer. Going into 2008, this was the last of the graphs that I published. This came right from the Federal Reserve, except for this part, which I use a service called Shadow Government Statistics for. Just a disaster waiting to happen. You were choking off the liquidity of the economy at the level of households and small businesses, but there was no way to stop this insane spiral of the Chinese selling their goods to us at artificially low prices and thereby collecting huge amounts of money that they would then lend back to us because we didn't want to do what was necessary, raise taxes, lower spending to get the economy under control. Now, one last thing I want to tell you. I always show this graph, and it's always people say, well, what the hell is this spike over here, this massive spike? Oh, and I explain, that's a really cool thing. 9/11 happened. There was a lot of worry that there was going to be this massive run on banks after the attack. So the Federal Reserve launched this incredible project, moving huge truckloads of money to every bank in the country so that every bank had as much money as it could possibly need if people were freaking out and running banks because some idiots had attacked us. So the Federal Reserve moved all this money into the banks in these truckloads with armored convoys going everywhere in the United States just to get the money into those banks so that they didn't have any worry about collapsing because of a run on the bank. And then a few months later, they got all the money back out of the banks. Except that there's one problem. September, the first week of September, the days right before 9/11. 9/11. What do you see? The money was being moved to the banks in the week before 9/11. Do you see it? This is a Fed chart. You do see it, don't you?
Well, where's 9/11?
9/11 is right here. It's the last day of the move of money. The money was going into the banks well before that day. It's right there in the charts. The banks were being provided with the liquidity to handle a run on the banks a week at least before 9/11 happened. It's right there in the charts. Do you see it? That was money in trucks that was being hauled to the banks. In the early days, September in the first week, the day, the Friday before, and then the day of, the money was moving. Why would that have been going on? Nah. Anyway, that's all I have for you.